Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
What was benefited most from your time out? The mind or the body? I mean, did you actually have a break, given that you hadn't really put a racket down for 20 years?
I did. I took a couple of months off of not training and not playing, which for me was just so unreal because since the age of four, that's really all I did.
Yeah, Maria Sharapova there speaking at the Rod Laver Arena just ahead of the Australian Open when she had returned triumphantly onto the court holding the Australian Open trophy. This after she served a 15-month suspension for failing a drugs test at the Australian Open 2 years ago. Sean, I guess you, like the rest of us, were wondering how, with that history, Maria Sharapova has been welcomed back with such open arms.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we've seen this already when she came back. You know, she was greeted with triumphant cheers and whoops of Maria. So it wasn't a surprise. And the research sort of shows that people talk a good game when it comes to doping, but they don't stop watching their favourite sports. They don't stop supporting their favourite players.
Yeah, we don't have lifetime bans in sport. So Maria Sharapova would always have the option of returning. But what we saw there, like the line of questioning, the benefits of a timeout, her being able to speak about it being such an unreal experience that she hadn't had this opportunity since she was 4 years old. Like, that sort of stuff, you can't pull the wool over people's eyes. Like, surely everybody can see through this.
Well, again, you write anything negative about Maria Sharapova on Twitter and you'll get her army coming at you. They'll say, well, Madonna, it was for a heart. It didn't, it wasn't a proper performance-enhancing drug, etc. So on, which is clearly nonsense. Because before big matches, she was told to take more of their stuff, and also with the World Anti-Doping Agency's liability laws, fail a test, you fail a test, and that's what she did.
The headline in your article is Maria Sharapova's reception, a reminder of the indifference to doping. Like, watching the reception she has received in Melbourne over the past week, both from spectators and from the authorities, like, indifference might even be too strong a word for it. It doesn't seem as though, with the exception of a few outspoken voices amongst her fellow players, that anybody really cares that Sharapova doped.
No, and we see this in other sports as well. I mean, I was chatting to a Canadian researcher last week about what happened, what's been happening in Major League Baseball. And he looked at every single case that a player was banned from 2005 to 2013. And it always followed a similar pattern. You know, there'd be outrage. People would say this is disgraceful. The home attendance would fall by about 8%, which is significant. And, you know, actually attendances throughout the league would drip a little bit. But then after 15 days, that effect had vanished. So people thought it was a bad thing, but then we all quickly moved on.
Yeah, people still wanted to go out. People still wanted to be entertained.
Exactly. And we see the same thing in cycling. You know, clearly cycling has had huge problems, probably still has huge problems. But most TV markets, even the effect of a scandal, it doesn't seem to last more longer than a year. So there was a Belgian economist that looked at the TV figures in Netherlands and Denmark and a few other places, and they remained stable. And in Spain, they dipped for a year after the Landis and the Rasmussen cases in 2006 and 2007. But then again, they returned to normal. And I don't think anyone expects TV figures to dip in Britain, despite what's happened with Chris Froome recently.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised in a way with Sharapova that she has been able to move on so quickly. It certainly seems like she was winning that PR battle very quickly after she received the ban. She received support, which was quite unusual, it felt at the time, from quite a few of her sponsors. Generally, when there is a doping issue, you see sponsors drop the athlete very quickly. With Maria Sharapova, they were happy to stand by her. And they probably feeling that there was a certain degree of support for Sharapova within the women's tennis authority. And if they don't feel there's an issue, I guess supporters are going along to the Australian Open, to any other of the big tennis events, and thinking, well, if they don't care, why should we?
I mean, I think, do you remember, you know, when the financial crisis, you know, a decade or so ago, you know, banks were considered too big to fail. And I kind of think Maria Sharapova is one of those few sports people that's probably the same, that because she put so many people into stadiums, because so many people want to watch her play, because she has all these, you know, mega sponsors, you know, people are more willing to turn the other way, look the other way, give her the benefit of the doubt. welcome her back. I'm not sure that's the case for everybody, but it certainly seems to be the case for her.
You mentioned within the article an academic paper by Bruno Buchel, Nobody's Innocent, The Role of Customers in the Doping Dilemma. And his research shows that we're sometimes in a lose-lose situation because the more reliant a sport is on the revenue from consumers, the less likely its authorities are to jeopardise things by strenuously testing their biggest stars. And I guess that feeds into what you're saying there, that quite often with most sports, that the bigger the name, and even though in cycling we saw the biggest name eventually fall, that honestly, we can't look at the major sporting authorities around the world and think that they're full, wholeheartedly going after their biggest stars.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think there are good people in anti-doping. Some of them do their best, but the system is so flawed, it's beyond belief. I mean, I was chatting to a very successful track athlete who was trained some of the world's best athletes, and including, I think, some dopers he would concede, although he said he didn't know at the time. And he says, if you gave him £5 or £6 million, which is nothing compared, you know, UK anti-doping gets, I think, 26, 27 million. He said, I could bring down more cheats with that kind of money. I would know the people, I would offer incentives, I could do it, you know. And effectively, anti-doping authorities aren't doing enough. They're not able to do enough because the laws are weighed against them. But also, I think you're right. If the IOC and sports were that concerned, they would have some kind of levy that would then pay more into anti-doping. You'd get more sort of police involved. You'd have more coordination internationally. I mean, as things stand, you know, if you don't fail a drugs test, you will, you know, you'll get away with it, you know, unless a whistleblower can do what we did in Russia. And it is just too easy to evade, you know, a dope test.
That is what you were saying there a minute ago, almost at odds in what we quite often hear about anti-doping, that the testers are behind, that quite simply the way modern science is working, that it's impossible for the testers to keep up. Whereas what you're saying is, actually, if you were to go and invest substantially more money, we would catch substantially more athletes.
I mean, I think there's a two-part thing to that. First of all, if every athlete was getting not only urine tested, but it was getting blood tested, was having, you know, hormone tested at every test, I think that would help. But I also think actually so much of it comes down to attracting whistleblowers, to you know, having proper investigative teams. You know, the World Anti-Doping Agency until recently had one investigator, one. Now they have six, and the guy in charge, a guy called Gunter Juncker, is a good guy, and he did quite a lot of good stuff in Russia. But that's not enough. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, it's bringing a pea shooter, you know, to a war where people are fighting with machine guns. It's, you know, it's not good enough.
So they've gone from one to six. Like, what's the aim? Where do they think they'll be in 2-3 years' time?
Well, I mean, when I've spoken to Juncker, he would like to see more investigations into other countries like we saw with Russia. But he basically said, you know, that cost £1 million or $1 million, whatever it was. You know, anti-doping agencies don't have a lot of money, and he sort of said, well, I'll do them the best I can, but you know, but I'm limited by my resources and the money that's out there. And no one, whether it's sports or governments, wants to fund anti-doping. It's sort of, you know, why spit in the soup? Why, you know, highlight, you know, things? Why destroy the show? And that's a big problem here.
Something else you touch upon, and I don't think this will come as a major surprise, is that the research suggests that when it comes to clean sport, people believe in their own country's athletes more than foreign ones. And you touched on Chris Froome, Bradley Wiggins, and the belief that's there within Britain for that. And I guess it's not just countries, it's probably supporters of the sport, which we see with cycling. We get it constantly when we cover doping in cycling as to, why don't we cover the other side of cycling? Why don't we cover what's actually happening at the Tour de France right now? Why does it have to be perceived? Why is it negative, I guess, is how cycling fans will perceive it. And I guess here with tennis fans as well, they feel that maybe their sport has been almost unfairly picked at.
Yeah, I mean that research, which was done by a group of Norwegian researchers, they found the more interested people were in a sport, the more liberal their attitudes were to doping. So they basically, in their view, maybe, you know, for the people that really like a sport, the desire to watch it was stronger than the reluctance towards doping. And the other thing that was quite interesting, they also tended to be less motivated to reduce their purchases from sponsors involved in sports where doping occurred than from others. So they still buy the kit, they still buy the uniform, they still proudly wear, you know, the US postal kit, even after Armstrong's been busted, or other examples which we could mention. So we might talk again when it comes to doping, but deep down, I think we quickly make excuses for it happening.
That actually surprised me, that statistic, that the greater sports fan you are, the more liberal you are in terms of doping, because I would have worked on the understanding that actually the people who are very into sport care about this and they want clean sport. And actually, maybe it's just your average man on the street who, you know, turn when he's watching tennis, he might watch the Grand Slams. If he's watching golf, he might watch the majors, but wouldn't have really a deeper interest than that. It seems surprising that actually those people who enjoy sport more, maybe it's more people who are focused on that one sport.
Maybe. I think some of it does come down to identity. I mean, we increasingly live in a society now where it's our team, it's our, you know, our player that we support. And, you know, you only have to look at social media when Liverpool play Manchester United, you know, a referee makes a decision, United fans are all, you know, if it goes their way, it was great. And we seem to be completely tied in, which is ridiculous. I mean, I always assumed that when the Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson was busted after breaking the 100-meter world record, it shattered athletics' reputation. And certainly I was an 13-year-old boy, and it did mine. But during the next Olympics in 1992, they surveyed athletics fans, and only 22% agreed that doping was a determined factor of Olympic success. Only 22%, even after we had Ben Johnson. And I just think, okay, that's a while ago, and I imagine those figures have changed now because we know a lot more about doping and so on. But it just goes to show people are reluctant. You know, when someone's shouting a message, if it's a message you don't want to hear, you know, people put their fingers over their ears and you know, la-la-la it away.
Yeah, it's depressing in many ways. And I wonder, like, how do we change that? Because, like, this week here in Ireland, I don't know if you've been following the case with Gerben Grobler, who was a player signed by Munster last summer who had previously served a 2-year ban for doping. In fact, he only returned from the doping ban at the end of 2016, played for Racing last year, served the ban when he was in South Africa. Now, we've been asking the question about whether he should be brought to Irish rugby at all, considering the IRFU's policy is one of zero tolerance towards doping, and also been asking the question about whether it fits in with Munster's brand values. Like, they speak within their values on their website about unfaltering integrity, and we've had quite a reaction, to put it mildly. Quite a bit of it positive, saying, yes, listen, we need to question the IRFU, we need to question Munster. What sort of an example does it set to young players within Irish rugby that we are willing to give dopers a second chance? But also a huge amount that this is anti-Munster bias, that as a Dublin radio station we're pro-Leinster, that everyone's entitled to a second chance, that this is a complete witch hunt. It seems as though a huge amount of people just don't want to hear about it when it's one of their own.
No, absolutely. I mean, my view is always been, you know, you go to church as a young lad, that, you know, the priest would say, you know, every saint has a past, every sinner has a future. And I think you have to believe, you have to give people a chance to redeem themselves, to reform. What worries me, though, is that, you know, people don't, and this is a broader point, but the people don't seem to accept nuance anymore. They don't seem to, I mean, well, not all people, but too many people, you know, aren't willing to sort of say, well, this isn't black and white, there are greys here, this isn't ideal. I think it is tied in with identity, it's tied in with just the way we are now. I always found it bizarre when, you know, the economy was crashing around people's ears, you'd have all these people again getting wild on social media about football and not having the same reaction about people struggling with, you know, their lives and so on. But that's perhaps the way we are hardwired psychologically. You know, if you put two sets of people on a team blue and a team red, you know, that team, you know, suddenly, you know, if you're in team blue, you think you're best of your team, and you think less of team red. I think that's just perhaps how we are. But I'm no psychologist, but that's my instinct.
Yeah, it certainly does seem as though we have a higher threshold when it comes to doping for our own people. Like, again, going back to, say, currently Chris Froome, even Bradley Wiggins. The second, if those accusations were made of a Russian athlete, of a Kenyan athlete, of an Ethiopian athlete, you wouldn't think for a second about it. You would just assume that person is a doper. You would never look any further deeper into the situation.
Yeah, no, you're right. And interestingly, that applies to athletes as well. I didn't mention this in my piece, But they've done studies on, well, they've asked athletes from different countries, you know, do your fellow countrymen dope, do you think? And then they've asked, you know, what about, you know, people from X, Y, Z country? And you have the same statistics, you know, no, I don't think my countrymen or countrywomen dope. Yes, I do think the Russians, Kenyans, Ethiopians, other countries are at it. And I think we have to be realistic. The way the world is, people will cheat. Not everyone cheats. I think, you know, there are some people I would be fairly confident, you know, are doing things the right way. But people are going to cheat. And when there are rewards for cheating, or even whether they're financial, even just winning, people will take advantage of them. And it doesn't matter what skin color you have, where you were brought up, you know, people will look to gain advantage. And with the system as easy to manipulate and get through when it comes to doping, you know, it's why wouldn't you in some ways when the rewards are so great in some cases?
Do we need to hear more then from current athletes, from their compatriots? So in tennis, we've seen what Maria Sharapova, Eugenie Bouchard came out quite strongly about it. Caroline Wozniacki came out unhappy with the preferential treatment. But Andy Murray's been quite outspoken about doping within tennis and within sport in general. But an awful lot of sports people just like to keep their head down. And so this doesn't remain to the forefront of people's thoughts. So the only story around the Australian Open in the lead up was probably the injury crisis within the men's game, rather than Maria Sharapova's return 2 years on. But if the players were speaking, and again, maybe when you're an athlete, you're not thinking like this, but if Caroline Wozniacki kept that drum beating week in, week out, week in, week out, eventually maybe it does just seep properly into the public conscience.
Possibly. I mean, I have some sympathy, though, because if you do speak out, you're going to get hammered by people on social media. And I can understand why sometimes you think, what, you know, why, you know, I get abuse when I write, you know, when I've written about Team Sky, you know, I get dozens of letters, you know, I could read some of them out, you know, threatening all sorts. But I mean, that's only, you know, it's not that many. If you, you know, if you have, you know, 1 or 2 million followers on Twitter and you're being bombarded, why, you know, why bother? I mean, I really think it's up to your authorities to almost do far more, to accept there are more people cheating out there and they want to find them. I mean, really, you want sheriffs, you want people looking for crime. And I don't think the current anti-doping system has many sheriffs.
Mm. I was thinking about it, like the choices that we make as consumers as to what we want from sport, and looking at it in other aspects of life. And like we watch, and we, the clothes we wear, we know they're made by big sportswear giants. They're probably manufactured in sweatshops in China, but listen, we look at them, we go, that looks nice, they're a nice pair of runners, I'll buy them anyways. And that's every aspect of life. We have to make decisions, and they're probably quick fire decisions, not overly thought through decisions on a moral, ethical basis. We all struggle to be a little bit consistent, and that for some people, doping is an issue that means they will turn off a sport. But for an awful lot of people, it's something they simply don't think about. They just rush into it. They want to go. They want to be entertained. They want to go to the Rod Laver Arena. They get their ticket. And quite frankly, how the people on court have got there, they're not too bothered about it.
No, that's right. Although I do think, particularly with combat sports and also high impact sports like rugby, we do need to actually think about the dangers of drugs. I know I speak to a lot of people and they say, just let them all dope. And I think that's too simplistic, because first of all, you know, some people are high responders. So people used to say that Armstrong benefited more from EPO than other riders, for instance. But there's also a huge health impact. Not only for if you could be taking new drugs that haven't been properly researched and you could, you know, have serious consequences, but if you're a boxer, you're a fighter, you're a UFC fighter, you're a, you know, 20 stone prop, and you're also on steroids, that means you're going to punch hard, you're going to punch faster, you're going to hit someone harder. And we increasingly know about the dangers of not only concussions, but these subconcussive hits, these, you know, tiny little things we get every time we play a sport and people are crashing into our heads, and how they can lead to, you know, CTE later in life. So I do think it's important that we realize this is a problem, and this is something we should be trying to face and tackle. And at the moment, sadly, I think a lot of people in sports and in anti-doping pay lip service to it, which is a terrible thing.
Yeah, it certainly, I think, is one of the reasons why it is such an important topic in rugby, as you say, those sports where there are collisions and where you can do destructive damage to somebody else that you're coming up against. And also even within those individual sports, even going right the way back to the start to Maria Sharapova taking Meldonium, she's never come out to explain since why exactly she was taking it and what she's been taking since to replace it if it was so important to her.
Exactly. I mean, I think if you believe, you know, that she had a heart condition, you know, I've got some, you know, 6-pound coins that I can sell you, or I've got some fairies at the bottom of my garden that you can take pictures of for a fee. I think that whole explanation is fanciful. I think if she had turned around and said, look, I was taking this stuff, it was legal, my Russian scientists had told me it'd give me a performance edge. I screwed up because I didn't read the thing. You know, yes, I take the punishment. I think you'd say, okay, it's not great, but fair enough. But she can't cut to this whole elaborate thing, which, I don't think anyone that with a rational and sort of sensible mindset would believe for a second.
There's a lot of very good journalists in Britain who've been covering the Team Sky story and have been covering doping in general, and same here in Ireland. And you get a sense that they are banging their head against a brick wall at times, trying to get the meshes through. If we're sitting here in 5 years' time, do you think we're going to be having the exact same conversation? Is there eventually going to be a tipping point? Or as you say, when we saw with Ben Johnson, we've seen with Lance Armstrong, we've seen with Maria Sharapova, that actually, no matter what happens, there's always a way back and there's always a public there that will go and buy this product.
I think sadly it's that. I mean, I'm just looking now at a letter I got sent a couple of months ago when I wrote about Chris Froome. And I won't mention the guy's name, but he wrote, I've just read your piece in today's Guardian about Chris Froome's world to victory. And I have to say, I found it one of the most shoddy, ill-informed pieces of serious journalism that I've read in a long time, and quite unworthy of newspaper with Neville Cardis, John Arler and Alistair Cook. I know you have an axe to grind in relation to Team Sky in general and Froome in particular, but this does not justify deploying half-truths, innuendo and downright misinformation and pursuing your ends. And he went on and on and on. And honestly, I've got hundreds, you know, either on Twitter or actual long in-depth emails or letters like this. I think as a journalist, you know, it's about trying to pursue the truth, trying to get to the story. It's not about having favourites. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily see it that way, though.
Yeah, it certainly seems as though the PR battle maybe at the moment has been won by big business and by the various sporting authorities. Sean, great stuff. Thanks a lot for taking the call.
No worries. Good speaking to you.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.